Is that you asking me?
Yes.
Yeah.
So I'm curious how to figure out what coordinate variable from the 3D faces are in the repository. Is that easy to figure out what they are? I haven't tried yet, honestly. I just want to know.
I think they're landmarks in the repository.
Okay, and they're labeled in such a way that would be pretty easy to figure out.
I'm sorry, you're breaking up. I can't hear you, Elizabeth. You're kind of breaking up.
Okay. So are they labeled in such a way that it might be kind of easy to understand what they are?
I've got Leah here with me.
They have the anthropometric names for them, and then their X, Y, and Z coordinates are the landmarks.
Okay, well then maybe
we can give you. If anything is not clear, or if you just want us to provide a definition for each one, I mean, I think that's. What the acronym? I mean, what it stands for? We can do that.
It's not an acronym anymore.
But will it be obvious then?
I think so.
I think it'll be obvious. Take a look, Elizabeth. If you're not sure at all, just email, email Leah, and we will. I mean, forget. Don't email me. Email Leah. Go right to the source, and we'll be glad to help make it clear. Don't worry.
Okay. Thanks.
Okay. Let's see who is here. Michael Charnas.
I am here. How are you? And Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to everybody. I'm doing okay. Jennifer Thomas is not here. Bill Barnett.
I'm here.
Ben Jones. Bullock. Scott Sal. Elizabeth Sal.
Yes.
Hi, Elizabeth. Jeff Post.
I'm here, yes.
Sarah Mattson. Tina Chen.
I'm here.
Tatiana's there. Peter's
I'm here.
Deepak is here.
Yes, I'm here.
Johann Eberhardt.
I am here.
John Hannigan. There.
Present.
Savage.
Here.
Susan Taper, Dan Savage,
here.
Bill Dunty,
here.
Bill Dunty,
yep, I'm here.
Okay. All right. Anyone join us late?
Yeah, Ken Jones.
Okay. Yeah, and Tom and Kathy.
And Kathy and Scott.
Turnout today. All right, so. Oh, Bill, tell me I need to pick up my phone to take it off speaker, and then I can't write. All right, so just a couple of action items, agenda for the agenda. That our annual face-to-face meeting is going to be March 19th and 20th. And Jill has sent you out a doodle poll, which contains information that we need in order to hold the sleeping rooms. So could everyone please fill that out and get that to her by next week on Tuesday? All right. Otherwise, we have contract problems with the hotel. All right. Now, our progress report for that meeting will be due on December 1st, and Jill has also sent out a Word document template, which is modeled after what's going to be required for NIH, and fill that out, send that to Jill by March 1st, and that'll give us enough time that we can get it out to the Science Advisory Board, and they can review it prior to the face-to-face meeting. Also, if you have any suggestions about people that you would like to see or have at the face-to-face meeting that are not normally included, if you have any suggestions for outside speakers, can you please email Jill and I about those? All right.
Any questions about the face-to-face meeting? Nothing? Wow. All right. All right. The thing that the admin core has been dealing with for the last couple of weeks are the developmental project selection for the next few years. We sent out requests for letters of intent through a number of sites, the RSA, ISBRA, et cetera, et cetera. We received, I believe, 38 requests. I'll tell you exactly in a second. We received 37 requests, and these were sent to the Science Advisory Board, people at NIAAA, for an initial ranking of these one-pagers. And I did not hear back from everybody. So far, we've basically been able to triage 12 of these, where everyone kind of agreed that their fit or their scientific quality or the investigator didn't really fit in with the mission of CFAS. And so those individuals were notified that their project would not be moving forward. I am hoping to get at least one or two more sets of reviews, maybe break it down and narrow it down a bit more and eliminate a few more projects. And then we're going to request five-page summary of the project from the rest of the individuals, so hopefully around in the low 20s, and send those out for external review. And then the Science Advisory Board, NIAAA, and the PIs will have input into the final selection of the developmental project. And hopefully we'll have all of this completed by the annual meeting, perhaps, and even invite those people whose projects are selected to come to that meeting if possible. Are there any questions about that? And can I beg the Science Advisory Board, who haven't already sent me evaluations, to please do that, since a reasonable amount of discrepancy among the reviewers. And I don't want to shortchange any of the people who sent in the one-pagers. Prior to the face-to-face meeting, a number of us will be meeting at the Vancouver meeting. If anyone has any questions about that, presumably everyone should have received the information on that meeting and a link so that they could get complimentary registration and a link telling you about what kind of support they can provide. Their budget was not as large this year as it has been in the past, and I do appreciate everybody chipping in to help get themselves to this meeting or to pay for hotel expenses. So I appreciate that. Any other comments or suggestions on that? Now, I have something, Jill, that was on my WebEx. It seemed to – just there it is.
I've got too much trouble.
All right. So
– it's small.
All right. So – Jill, were you going to talk about this concept proposal, or is that...
Sure, yeah, absolutely. So this is a list of the concept proposals which were submitted via the Google form this month, and so these are now available for comments or for people to reach out and ask to become a part of these projects, our papers. So this is the list that was received this month. We instituted this policy in August, but this is the first time we've had activity. So please note there will probably be some kinks with the publications committee and me trying to figure out the best way to distribute these, but this is the list that was received to date.
So this is Elizabeth. I just want to say that these we had a conference call about for the brain imaging a couple of days ago, and we all decided to put the things that we were actively working on in this format so people would know what we're doing. So we didn't put a whole lot of time into making them, you know, perfect, but we just thought we'd get them up there. So obviously questions you can ask me or the people who are responsible for them.
I think that's exactly what you wanted to do with the process, Elizabeth. I think that's perfect. Just to stress, I think that's exactly what we want you to do, is not go for perfection, get ideas out there so we can find out and get groups working on them.
Yeah.
Okay. Jill, did you have any other comments? Bill, you have some information that you've been sharing via email. I don't know whether you want to say anything else about that or if anyone has questions about this.
You mean Bill Barnett?
I do.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if there's that much more to say right now. We're having a staff meeting tomorrow to make sure that we have staff assignments to cover Michelle's departure. But Michelle did leave us on December 31st, and right now Helen is picking up a lot of the tasks that he had done. And we're in good shape. We just need to make sure we have all our planning wrapped around that. And part of that involves the central repository being down just because of there are kind of regular security reviews. And the last one picked up some things we needed to fix, and that was in the process of being fixed when Michelle left. So we need to follow up on that. But in the meantime, we can have the server running. It just can't be accessed from the outside. So we would be able to kind of process requests either for uploads or downloads, and then just send those data to you. So it's still functional. It's just not the way we would want to have it work, but we can kind of still keep in operation to support the project, you know, while that server is down. So I think that's pretty much the status of where we're at.
Bill, this is Sarah. Can I ask a question about the timeline in terms of, so it's kind of a big deal to me. We can't upload or download. We have no access. So,
I know
that you will do it for us and that we definitely mm-hmm. appreciate that. I'm just wanting to know what's your timeline for getting this back up and running.
So I will have a better idea of that tomorrow after our staff meeting when we have a better assessment of the situation. Michelle didn't leave us with a lot of information about the status.
Do you have, so, I mean, can you give me a ballpark? Are we talking 6 months? Are we talking 2 days?
We're talking, my goal is before the end of the month. And that's with unanticipated.
And
no.
Do you know when it went down? I mean, the holidays, you know, we had the holidays, so there was probably less activity, fortunately, than usual in terms of upload.
And that was part of the plan. We took it down the week before Christmas. And it wasn't, so it didn't go down. You know, we took it down because of the vulnerabilities that, mm-hmm. that were discovered. So it wasn't like it crashed or anything.
Right.
And we just didn't feel it was in a secure enough spot to leave it up and running mm-hmm. and potentially be compromised. So that's when I signed Michelle to work on it. So now Helen is working on that, and I think that one of the things we want to do is an assessment of what it will take. I think it's some relatively minor code changes, and then we have to do some. We have our security office has a security scanner that runs through and checks it for vulnerabilities, and that's what picked up these. And once it passes clean, then we'll be able to return it to production. To really answer your question, and I think by the end of this month, we should have it back up and running. And in the meantime, you know, we'll handle these manually.
Okay.
Okay, and I want to thank Helen. She did manage to send me the data in the central repository, and I think her idea of putting that on a table and a chart, the progress would be a great idea, so that would be of value to me. So if Helen's not on, for me for getting that done and that information to me prior to this call, because progress seems to be moving ahead, and I think we're doing pretty good shape.
I'll be sure to let her know, Ed.
Thank you. Okay. Anything on the data sharing? Are we complete on that?
This is Bill. That's probably me also.
Yeah.
Jennifer and I talked last week, and we have a draft of the new page that will go on the data sharing page on the CFAS website, and that draft is in the works, and I thought she was actually going to try to have it up for this meeting, but I saw that that didn't happen. The things that we have in place are the listing of the data sets we're going to share, the data sharing policy, and the form to fill out for people to request data. The last thing that we need is the actual data use agreement that will be signed by the principal investigator. Now that we have the policy, we can use that as the principles for which we draft the data use agreement. But I think that's really the last piece we need to complete the circle.
All right, because I have been getting an inquiry about it, so I just wanted to get up to date on that. All right, I am going to turn this over now to Peter and Tatiana and for their WebEx presentation.
Peter, are you okay?
Yeah, do I have to start, hit the quick start button?
Yeah.
I think I do, yeah.
There, right. We're on there. Just expand that and...
full page view if you can. Oh, is that as big as it'll get? Yeah, maybe.
See that first, it's just the first slide with the title, Phase Trainer Analysis Update. Yeah.
Hi, I'm going to interrupt really quick. If you guys have a box on the right, you can click on that, and then it'll make the whole page bigger.
Ah, thank you, Jill.
Okay, first of all, I'll apologize if I start coughing. I've still got the remnants of a chest infection, and occasionally I have this paroxysm of coughing. But I'm hoping Mike will sing a song, you know, while I cough and just keep you happy. Okay, so I think mainly I'm going to be doing the presentation. Tatiana and I spoke yesterday about what we will do in this presentation. So I've called it Face Brain Analysis Update. It's slightly a lie, actually, but I'll explain why. So just to remind people, we have four objectives in our project, and the one I think people might be wanting me to talk to is this business about combining face, neurobehavioral data, and brain images. But I want to leave that until probably the face-to-face meeting for a very good reason, and I think the reason will become clear when I explain what I'm going to do right now. So in parallel with combining face and brain and the sort of cognitive data, we also were supposed to look at a more diverse comparison of exposed and controls, in other words, an ethnic diverse comparison. So we were supposed to be looking at repeating the CAPE colored analysis that was published in the pediatrics paper in the Caucasian CFAS report. And because that has come out to be slightly negative, what that caused us to do was to readdress something which I now has generated a couple of positives, and so I want to explain how that's happened. And in particular, one positive is in objective one, which is the screening tool. So one thing that's come out of that is we now have the something ready that could go out and be shipped to people for doing some screening of faces, clinical use. And I'll demonstrate that as I go through. So I'm going to start with this comparison of the CAPE colored data at cohort and the CFAS Caucasian. So just to remind you, in the pediatrics paper, Mike's pediatrics paper, we had this cohort of the Jacobson data set, and we had each child was labeled clinically as a control, HC, FAS or PFAS. I think there were 22 FAS, 26 PFAS, or heavy exposure, in other words, couldn't proven exposure but couldn't be put in the FAS or PFAS category. Now, the equivalent in the Caucasian CFAS, we started out actually initially
including Hispanic as well. But because the numbers of FAST, for instance, without Hispanic is 33, but with is 34, i.e. we only gained one with the definite diagnosis of FAS. And we would have had a big imbalance in terms of the additional Hispanic controls and HE we would have added. I felt I wasn't happy doing that. And also, some of you may know, we published a paper last year showing that you shouldn't be mixing ethnic groups too much in your controls. We showed, for instance, that Dutch women are different from British women in the mid-face, and for that reason, I can imagine a reviewer would come down hard on us if we were mixing too many ethnic groups, especially with that imbalance of only one FAS but lots of controls and heavy exposure. So I've omitted them. The other thing I've had to adjust as well is that you notice that in the Caucasian CFAS cohort, we don't have a PFAS subcategory. So that means in the comparison, I've removed the PFAS. So now we've just got the 22 FAS being used from the Cape Colored report. And the first comparison we did in the pediatrics paper was to see whether just using the face, we could get a classification that agreed with the clinical diagnosis. And the way we do that, I'm afraid I'm going to have a cough, sorry. I hope you didn't hear that. So the first thing we looked at was how much just the face classification agrees with the clinical labeling of the children. And that turns out to be estimating the probability of agreeing with a clinical diagnosis of a random pair of faces, one selected from the controls and one selected from the FAS group. Now, when we did that with the Cape Colored group, we got results like this. So the three columns with blue labels, CM, LDA, and SVM, are different mathematical techniques, closest mean, linear discriminant analysis, support vector machines. And the numbers underneath are probabilities of agreeing with the clinical diagnosis. So you can see for just that thin line, the midline profile of the face, it's very high, almost perfection, very high for the whole face, similarly to the profile. Now, in the paper, we didn't use this region called the malar region, and I've introduced it for a number of reasons in this reanalysis. This is the region I'm talking about, this region capturing that sort of lateral mid-facial region corresponding very much to the zygoma, the zygomatic arch. And the reason I've included it was because when you look at the depth signature map of the average FAS compared to controls, you get this strong signal in that zygoma region on the left and right of the face. So that's why I included it. And now, is it interesting to see that if you just look at that region of the face only, that's this region up here, you can actually get very high agreement with the clinical diagnosis. And I was a bit surprised at that. But we had noticed a lot of mid-facial flatness in the Cape-colored cohort. We did have the nose in the old in the pediatrics paper, but then we actually had a region of the whole upper lip, which I've now reduced just to the philtrum. And you can see the philtrum on its own does not do as well at all, substantially less than these other parts of the face. When we now compare that to the Caucasian, the striking thing is the dramatic reduction in the agreement with the clinical diagnosis from just looking at the face. For both the profile, the full face, and the malar region, they drop substantially. The nose, for some reason, goes up a few percentage points, but the dramatic thing is that the philtrum is dramatically better in the Caucasian group, and that raises, you know, a question mark. What is happening? Why is the whole face and the mid-face doing less well, but the philtrum's doing better? And these are the things that started making me wonder about just how we're looking at the different face parts, and in particular, the philtrum. You might remember that I've always said that because the FAS group have much smaller faces overall, that often swamps the subtle differences in the philtrum. So I was hoping next to think of how we might address the philtrum in a better fashion.
But could you stop for a minute, Peter?
Yeah.
Peter, it's Ken. So aren't you saying that there's a difference, though, relative to Caucasian and Cape colored as far as the philtrum is concerned? Isn't the philtrum...
In terms of its ability to agree on just using the shape of the philtrum to predict the clinical diagnosis, there's a difference. Yeah. And
between Caucasians and Cape colored.
Yes.
Yes.
And this is what I'm going to address now and try and explain why that's
okay.
Peter, I have a question. The philtrum is in the Cape colored was measured. I mean, how do you get a philtrum measurement? Was it the
The overall shape of the philtrum.
And you're measuring that shape. You're not using the 5-point scale, the 4-D
code. No, at all. I'm not using the lip philtrum code at all. I'm using the 3D shape of the philtrum.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
I forgot to mention that I can understand why there's a difference in the malar region, because if you look at the corresponding heat map of the Caucasian average, which is this second image at the bottom here, you can see you don't get that strong signal in this malar region as you do in the Cape average. So what about the philtrum? Well, again, I just said that the reduction in the size of the overall face is a problem. And so I wanted a way of looking at the philtrum which didn't depend on size. And, you know, after a few days of thinking about it, came to the conclusion that maybe we should be looking at the curvature. Because when you look at the philtrum, I don't know whether my cursor's coming up, you know, you can see that groove. You can see that shadow causing the change in the curvature. And so I asked Mike to look into our sort of collection of primitives that allow us to look at various geometric things of surfaces. And was there one dealing with curvature? And he found one, but it didn't quite do what we wanted. But we tweaked it, and it gives a result like this. And let me explain. So this is a heat map of the average curvature at any point on the face. And where the face is very concave, like the nose is concave sticking out, you get a blue color. Where it's relatively flat, you're getting a green color. And where it's very convex. Where it's very concave, you're getting this red. So where you've got grooves and inward curvature, you've got red, and where you've got outward, you've got blue. And immediately you can see what that's doing in the philtrum. You can immediately see you've got that redness showing the groove of the philtrum, the inward sort of curvature, and even a touch of the blue of the philtral pillars coming outward. So immediately we thought, this is looking interesting. Another thing as well is, if you look, can you see how it identifies the shape of the upper lip? And it's really bringing that out. And in fact, we immediately thought, that's a way of maybe of making some kind of measurement of the thinness of the upper lip. So it looks like we could get two things for the price of one out of this, not just the philtrum, but maybe the lip measure that we might want to make more objective. But what I want to emphasize is that the more you look at the philtrum, it's more complex than you think in its shape. There are two types of curvature. For instance, if I slice this philtrum with a horizontal plane, you'll get a curvature kind of going in and out, like this sort of curve I'm making with the mouse. If I slice it with a vertical plane, we'll get curvature along this sort of curve. So we wanted to split those up into separate curvatures. And the way you do this mathematically is you define an axis from the center. This is the center of the upper lip, this lower point, and the upper point, the subnasale, is the point where the underneath the nose, where the philtrum becomes the columella, or the bit underneath the nose. Now, mathematically, what you do is, this is called a right-hand rule. You grab that axis with your right hand, and you stick your thumb in the direction of the axis, and your fingers are rotating around the curvature that you're interested in. That's a curvature that's going into the philtrum. If you think, if you had a big enough philtrum, you could snuggle your fist in there and that would give you some curvature in that sort of in the horizontal plane. And then at right angles to that, we call that groove. We're going to use a separate word. If you think of an axis at right angles, and we use an axis which is made by the outer corners of the left and the right eye, and if you now put your right hand on that axis and you look at where your knuckles are, that's giving you a curvature in the vertical sense, okay? And we call that curl. So that's what I mean by the difference between groove and curl. And it is interesting to see that these two are independent. You get philtrums which have got lots of groove, no curl, and vice versa. And I just want to give you some examples to illustrate. So I haven't got a measure yet, or I'm not, I think I've got a measure, but I'm not going to show it to you yet for measuring groove and curl. But imagine if you could. I'm going to show you examples at the extremes. So, for instance, here's a philtrum, and these are real examples of children in our data set. So here I'm coloring the groove. So the red means I've got horizontal curvature. And you can see bits of blue here, which is the philtrum pillar. And here I'm the same thing, but I'm covering the curl. So you can see it going in, and then at the top of the lip it comes out again, curls out. So that's got lots of groove and lots of curl. Here's another philtrum which has got groove, which is on the left picture here. You can see that redness, and you can see the blue of the filtral pillars. But when we look at curl, there's none of that vertical curvature. So that's why it's mainly green. And I'm mainly concentrating on the mid part of the philtrum. If there is curl at the top here where it curls outwards, and then there's some blue here at the bottom where it curls around the top of the upper lip. So these are all what I think you would call normal-shaped philtrum. But what about this one? This is low on groove, low on curl. I mean, this is what I'm sure Ken would say, classic FAS philtrum. So you've got lots of green when you try and color the groove. There's no groove, really. And the curl in the center is all green eye. There's just no curl in the center. There's a little bit at the top and the bottom. So I would call that FES. Now, but what about this one? I wonder what Ken would say about this. So now there's no groove. It's flat in the horizontal plane. If you chop that horizontally anywhere, it would be flat. That's why it's green, except for that little bit of yellow just there in the center. But it's got lots of curl. So it's like a ski jump. You can imagine you could kind of jump on this and ski all the way down and jump off the end. And it's quite flat in one sense but curved in the other. Now, we see quite a few of these, and I think they're typically labeled FAS as well.
Are they Cape colored?
This particular one, I can't remember, to be honest. But I know why you're saying that, and that'll come up on the next slide, I think. Or a future slide. But certainly we have to kind of, adjust that there are these differences amongst all the children. I mean, this top left example, I think it probably is FAS, but as Ken says, it might be different if you're looking at a different ethnic group. But I just wanted to show the variation. Now, we became so interested in this, and Mike did such a good job on it, We actually put it into our software. So I'm going to put the phone down now while I just flip to this other piece of software. So what you should see now is our face marking software, but actually we've changed its name more recently to screening software. So this is not a real face. This is an average face of male Caucasians around about 5 years old, I think. And I just wanted to illustrate what you might be able to do in terms of using this for screening. So if I press this button up here with a sort of red on the green background, it invokes the curvature calculation. So immediately we can see the curvature of this average face. And if I change the sensitivity, and I think this is important for you to see, if I make it less sensitive or more sensitive, we get obviously stronger colors. because I'm showing it regions of, you know, lesser or more curvature by changing sensitivity. But what you can, importantly, what you can see is this is showing you filtral groove in red and the pillars in blue. If I actually switch it to show just the groove curvature, it's even better. So you can now see the red in the middle showing the groove, the inward curvature, and the outward curvature of the filtral pillars. So this is very much showing to you the curvature on the filtrum of this child. When we're looking at the groove curvature, I would ignore the rest of the face because it's not really, you know, this is a strange axis we've picked, so that all these other colors perhaps are not so relevant. You'll see some spasmodic blues and reds here and there, like down here. This is really noise in the data set, which is introduced partly by the camera because it makes slight mistakes on individual parts of the face, or by our methods of, you know, not getting the landmarks in exactly the right place and when we're doing all this correspondence. So we introduce a bit of noise, but generally speaking, it's pretty good. Now, if I flip to the curl curvature, you can see, again, if I change the sensitivity, this is really bringing out the vermilion border of the upper lip, I think. Well, and the lower lip, of course. So, you know, as I said before, this is looking good as a candidate for helping us to define the thinness of the vermilion of the upper lip. So that's an average face. What happens if we look at a real child? So this child visited us last year, and he's going to be featured in a TV program about fetal alcohol syndrome being made by one of the major UK channels, ITV. And they asked if we would look at his face because he hasn't yet got a full clinical diagnosis of FASD. He's going to see Raj Mukherjee sometime later this year to get a proper clinical diagnosis. But we said we'd look at his face. Now, what do you think, Ken? He's a big boy. He was actually bigger than average, I think. He has got an unusual upper lip. But his behavior was quite erratic. He was, you know, very ballistic with little focus. A rather a nice boy, but you know, it was difficult to control him. He had some language problems, and he used language and some signing. But it is known that his mother drank pretty heavily during pregnancy. And this is something the parents have only found out very recently because he's adopted and they weren't told when he was adopted. Now, if I switch on the curvature button, you notice there's a bit more noise now as well in this image, because this is a raw image. I've not done anything to this image. I've just actually put a raw image in. And if I switch on the groove curvature, you can see that it's mainly green. I mean, he's really quite flat. And if I change the sensitivity, you can see we have to go down a long way before we see any red or yellow. We can see the filtral pillars, but really, he's very flat. So this is, you know, one way of evaluating in a slightly more quantitative fashion the flatness of the filtrum. And by looking at the curl, I don't think that perhaps on this particular child the curl works very well. It's perhaps a bit strong. But anyway, in a future date, I think we're going to be able to use that for the thinness of the upper lip vermilion. Now, because we were pleased with this, Mike then thought about adding something about eye measure. Now, if I go back to the original of the child, I haven't shown you is that actually there are some landmarks on this child's face, which you can now see. Just four, corners of the eyes, subnasale, and the center of the upper lip. And you can imagine those two on the lip here we were using to do the curvature. But the ones on the eyes we can use because now Mike's automated measure of the palpal fissure length. So you, and he's added some data from the FaceBase website. So at the, on this scatter plot, you can see age at the bottom and palpable fissure length, but it's a mean of groups of children that they've published on their data, on their website. And the cross is a bit small, but just here is this boy we're just looking at, and you can see he's really smack on the average. So his palpable fissure length is not at all small. Oops, I've gone too quickly. Hang on. Right. So how would you use this then with a new face? I'll just quickly show you that. So suppose you had a photograph. So over in this folder here, I've got a 3D picture. And this is what the clinician would do. They would grab the picture, drop it over here, and then ask to see it. And there it is. It's a statue, of course, of the German poet Schiller. But I wanted to use something sort of neutral. If I press the curvature button, I get, you know, curvature of, and you can, because this is a statue, it's very smooth, so there's hardly any noise in the picture. And you can see he's got a fairly smooth filter at the top. I don't know much about him, or the sculptor who made this sculpture. If I do groove, oh, sorry, yes. Mike, just remind me, I've forgotten to put the landmarks on. I can't see those things. Now I'm going to put the phone down again, and I'm going to put four landmarks on quickly. Okay, that's the landmarks. If we don't want to see them, we can hide them. And then if I hit the curvature button again, go back now to the groove, we can now see the groove. And it, so we can now see his filtral pillars, and we can see a little bit of a groove in his filtrum. I mean, this is not obviously a realistic example. I just wanted to show you. It's relatively quick and easy to use and to get some feedback on the shape of the face, particularly in the filtral region. Okay, so I've nearly finished. I just want to go back to this issue about the difference between the cape-colored and the Caucasian filtrum, which Ken was also obviously alluding to when he asked me earlier. So what you're seeing now is the average filtrum for the cape-colored controls. And I've got the shape on the left, as you know, as our sort of mesh of points. I've got the curl heat map and the groove heat map. And what you can see is that there's not a lot of curl. It's pretty straight, vertically speaking. If you look at the groove, you can see the filtral pillars in blue, and you can see in red the groove. Now, when we compare that with the Caucasian, what you notice is, and we've noticed this a lot, is that African filtrums are certainly sort of flatter, vertically speaking, than Caucasian. There's this still this sort of curvature vertically, which is why the greeny yellow here is not as intensely green as it is on the cape. And then you notice the filtral pillars are much stronger as well, and also the groove is more intense. So I think already in the controls, and maybe Ken was keeping this in mind as well, that the cape-colored have got a flatter filtrum at the top than the Caucasian population, because the groove is stronger and the filtral pillars are stronger. And you can even see it. Just about, I think, visually, that there is more flatness at the top of the filtrum. Now, what happens when you move across to the FAS diagnosed mean? You can see the shape has now become more flat. You can see that some of that curl that was there in the middle has gone. You can see that the groove is now almost gone, and there's been also some loss of the intensity of the dorsal pillars. If you do the same thing for the Caucasian group, something similar happens. And the thing that we really need to investigate is, and I'm hypothesizing, is that the change is greater. So in other words, the difference between this third bottom row picture and the last one on the bottom row is greater than the corresponding for the upper row. That the change you're getting when you look at the FAS mean compared to the control is greater. And that's, I think, why you're getting better discrimination, or better, rather not discrimination, but better agreement with the clinical labeling. Because
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
So the curvature presumably, because it depends on how you set the threshold on the heat map. Right, but isn't there like an absolute measure of curvature that's not subjective?
Well, these are all set at the same sensitivity, so you know it's acceptable to compare them with each other. They're all the
same. So you can use a standard. You don't have to just eyeball where you think it looks good on that little slide. You can standardize it.
No. Well, I mean, I think what we really need to do is to normalize it.
Okay.
But at the moment, it's proving a bit difficult. With most of them will normalize okay, but some of them don't normalize very well because of the noise, and you get a rather messy figure. But I think we can cure that. Obviously, in order to actually prove this quantitatively, that there is a bigger change in the FAS group in the Caucasians compared to the Cape is to convert this into a number. And so that's what we're doing and have been doing. In fact, Mike showed me some values just before we got on the call. So actually it is here, but we can't show you any results yet for large numbers. So I want to explain how we calculate the volume of the filtral groove.
Hey, Peter? Can give me about 5 more minutes because Tina has some data and she won't be around next month.
Okay, this is my last slide, I think.
Okay, good.
All right. So the top coloring of this filtrum is a groove coloring, so you can see the filtral pillars and the groove in the middle. The bottom one is the curl. And what we want to do is to find out what region we're finding the volume for. Well, actually, you can see that the lateral sides of this are very much dictated by the top of the filtral pillars and the top end and the bottom end are very much defined by the changes in the curl of it. But the important thing then is to identify this region, and we have a method called region groan, which I won't go into. And what it does is it identifies this region that we're interested in finding the volume of. And as soon as I saw that, it reminded me of when you stay in a posh hotel and they have these fancy sinks, you know. And what we're interested in, of course, is finding how much water we could put into that sink without spilling it. And that's going to give us the volume of the filter. And so we have a mathematical technique which involves, first of all, putting a lid on the filter and then using an arbitrary plane, projecting it onto a plane, which gives us a positive volume. Then we take a little facet in the mesh of the filtrum. We project that down onto the plane. That gives us a negative. And we do that for all of the bits of the lid and all the bits of the bottom of the sink, if you like. And then we add all the negatives together, all the positives, and we subtract one from the other. And that gives us the volume, which we've now got working. So we can actually calculate the volume of this of the dimple, if you like, of the filtral groove. So I just wanted to list a few discussion points that we'd like feedback on, if not now online because it's not time, but maybe by email. These Cape Caucasian differences: is it nutrition? Is it exposure pattern? And the fact that we can't also reproduce the prediction with the signature graphs, is that because we're using a different cognitive battery for the different groups? There are differences. I think the major difference is a skeletal one, and the filtrum difference is a soft tissue one. On the screening tune side, at the moment it's just visualization, but when we get the calculation going, it will be estimating, you know, the filtral groove for you. But I think that's ready now, and I'd like to send this to people within the consortium and get feedback on using it, and then we'll distribute it externally. And the filtrum measure, I say, I think is almost there. But what should we be doing with it? Should we be comparing it with the Astley charts? Should we be comparing it with the cognitive battery scores? And should we be comparing it with corpus callosum curvature and depth, you know, the change in the thickness of the corpus callosum? And that's why I'm delaying finishing off that face brain work, because I think this filtrum measure will give us a much stronger handle on the face brain results. And then finally, I've hinted that in the future, I think we've got a good chance of getting a nice quantitative upper lip measure. And I'll stop there.
Thanks, Peter. We only have about 9 minutes left, and I wanted to give Tina a chance to present her data.
Ed, what I have is probably would take more than a half an hour to go over. So just basically we've just gotten the initial results from the running the bead chip for methylation analysis on the same samples that Rajesh has been using to look at microRNA, and then Deepak is using as well. And so it's about 25 mothers who are heavy drinkers, who have kids, who have physical features and neurobehavioral impairments, so meet the criteria for FAS or PFAS, and then a comparison group of about 30 or so who had the same amount of alcohol but have no features and no growth or neurobehavioral impairment, and then a comparison group of unexposed, obviously unaffected kids. And we got some hits, so we got some 9 significant CPGs after adjustment for multiple testing that were all hypomethylated in the alcohol-exposed affected group in comparison to the alcohol-exposed unaffected group, and then a bunch of other stuff as well. So Kristen Jepson and her group have done a lot of stuff looking at the pathways and so on. So what I just we could present this, you know, at a separate meeting, or maybe the best approach would be to have Johan and Tatiana and Rajesh and Deepak look at this in advance and kind of discuss what the interpretation of it might be, and then we could present it to the group. Does that make sense?
Sounds like a plan.
Okay. Sounds great to meet you. Okay.
Okay, then I'm sorry, Peter, that I cut you off. Are there any questions for Peter?
Yeah, why, Peter, this is Kim, why didn't you talked about nutrition and other issues that might create this problem in soft tissue, not problem, but this difference in soft tissue. What about genetics?
Well, oh, yes, of course. Yeah, I mean, I just didn't list everything. There are lots of things that we need to talk about and appreciate people's comments.
Yeah.
Genetics as well.
Yeah, so is Faye Calhoun on the phone?
No. No longer.
Okay. So Faye is somebody that you should be studying. I don't know whether you have studied Faye at all. Do you have 3D?
Formally in meetings.
Yeah. Well, you know, she's got a very typical face of many of the Cape Colored. And Faye clearly was not prenatally exposed to alcohol. So I think that it would be a really an interesting exercise to look at her face and see if you can find any differences between what her face shows in terms of all this with a child who is affected, who is Cape Colored.
Yeah.
I mean, she's got a classic face.
Yeah.
Or not a classic face, but a classic filtrum, and particularly her filtrum.
Yeah.
So, Ken, I mean, obviously the racial differences in just the sort of typical African-American face or African face and
typical
Caucasian face.
Yeah.
That's, the embryos have to be different. The medial nasal, the size of the medial nasal prominences, which is what's affected here, the size of the medial nasal prominences has to be very different in those two racial groups.
Yeah.
I think if you look at Asian populations, and there probably aren't very many kids with FAS in Asian populations here, but there are a ton with holoprosencephaly. We're going to end up with the Africans at one end of the spectrum, the Caucasians in the middle, and Asians at the other end of the spectrum. And it has to do with the size of the medial nasal prominences. If you look at the black populations, they are riddled with major diastemas between their upper central incisors. Huge spaces. You don't see that very much. You don't see that very much in Caucasians. And that all has to do with the size of the medial nasal prominences. This is genetic. This is just, you know, looks like looking at two different species, two different strains of dogs or cats or any other thing. You know, faces are different shapes.
Right. I totally agree with you. I would, however, disagree a little bit with what you said, because when we went to South Korea, we found huge numbers of kids with the fetal alcohol syndrome, the face of the with smooth philtrums, et cetera, in South Korea.
Really?
So, yeah, we did. And so it was very interesting. And that to me is the only Asian population that I know has really been looked at. Ed, has anybody else been looked at in the Asian population?
I mean, there are some in Japan, but no large quantities, and not like we saw in South Korea.
Uh-huh.
I think the philtrum in the Asian population is going to be even more telling than it is in the Caucasians, and you know, compared to the black population. Because they are inherently smaller.
Mm-hmm.
Inherently bigger.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I guess, as a geneticist, I just want to make sure that we're all saying the same thing. So when you're saying genetics, you are describing what we could euphemistically call racial or ethnic differences. You're saying there are basic underlying differences across races that reflect differences that reflect genetic variation. So that's all you're saying. You're not saying something different, because am I right in how you're interpreting that?
Are you asking Kathy, which I assume?
I'm asking either one of you, because I guess I just when you said, well, it could be genetic, I just want to make sure that we're saying the same thing, because we're saying there are basic. Are you saying when you're describing it as genetic, you're saying underlying what could be described as racial or ethnic differences that are due to differences in genetic variation that just reflects different ancestry?
Absolutely.
Perfect. Okay, good. Then we're speaking the same language. Perfect. I agree with you. Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
Sorry.
Yeah, it's okay. So, Kathy, how would you get at that in a human?
Get at the racial differences in face?
No. The size of the medial nasal processes.
I don't know. It's awfully hard to dissect out those little human embryos.
It is that.
So I think your idea about filter width is a good one.
Uh-huh.
You know, were you able to show that the philtrum is wider in people who have diastemas?
No, never looked.
The frenulum, I meant.
Yeah, now I know what you're talking about. Yeah. We've never looked.
No, but maybe you just measure the width of the upper incisors from one central to the other, side of one central to the other central, because
that's
pretty much what your medial nasal prominence is.
Yeah. One of the things that Andy Hull had suggested was that in doing prenatal diagnosis, we could be looking at the width of that, the teeth, the primary dentition, because it's coming in relatively early, and we could look at that from the standpoint of whether it was a good early prenatal sign of the fetal alcohol syndrome by virtue of being a sign of smaller medial nasal processes.
Yeah, I would measure the distance from the outer borders of the the distance between the outer borders of the two upper centrals.
Uh-huh.
Well, there's certainly a lot of things to look at and a lot of things to do. Our hour is over, and I noticed that people are signing off. So we didn't have a time to review the individual projects. Ken, you're on for speaking at the next WebEx. So,
am I? Did I offer to do that, or am I being assigned that?
No, you offered.
Did I? What's the date of that?
You offered and signed. Jill?
Oh, I did.
Jill?
Yeah, sorry. I haven't purchased my 2015 calendar yet, so I couldn't tell you quick. Hold on.
I was pretty sure you were on for next time.
That'd be Wednesday, February 4th.
Wednesday, February 4th, huh?
At 10 o'clock.
Okay.
That was what you're doodling. I think Yo probably responded for you.
Okay.
Are you here?
We're looking
yeah,
forward
I'm here.
To that. We're looking
okay,
yeah. forward to that.
I'll put it in my book because it's certainly not on there. So, but I can certainly do it.
All right. And because we have love to see your DVD and all that stuff.
Sounds so, good.
All righty then. Any other issues, Bill? Dunty? Any?
Yep. No issues here.
All righty. Thank you all, and Peter, I believe you wanted to talk, so stay on the line, all right? And he can do that, right, Jill? We don't...
Yep, you guys are good without me.
All righty. Thank you all very
Bye.
Much.
Bye.